Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, what a week of tennis we have just enjoyed. And Catherine Whittaker and myself, David Laura, here to talk about it here on the Tennis Podcast. I mean, most importantly of all, Catherine, I got my first ever set against Solihull Simon. But enough of that. We'll get on to that in a little while, because obviously that's what people really want. But we'll first of all, I think, talk about Nick Kyrgios winning Acapulco. Before that, we'll talk about Roger Federer getting his 100th ATP and Grand Slam title in total, 100 titles in all over the last 18 years. I mean, it's extraordinary to think. We'll be talking about all of that because it really has been the most fantastic week of tennis. Two ATP 500 events going on at the same time. A women's event in Acapulco, two slightly lower level, that one, but just stories galore coming out of Dubai and Acapulco. But first of all, Catherine, a very huge congratulations for getting the opportunity to present Amazon Prime Video's coverage from Indian Wells and the rest of the year. It's coming up. You're packed. You're ready to go. You've got your electric toothbrush packed. You've just been telling me about it. How exciting.
Oh, thanks very much, David. I've bumped Roger Federer's 100 down the pecking order.
Well, you know, I'm biased on this show. What can I say?
I was just having a whinge to you about how annoying I find it that there are certain things that you can't pack until the last minute. I mean, I know it's the ultimate first world problem, but it irritates me so much. And before people say, oh, you just get a second toothbrush, I feel like it's too decadent to have two sexy electric toothbrushes, one that only gets used a few weeks a year. Anyway, I digress. I just have the one excellent electric toothbrush, but I can't pack it until 7 a.m. tomorrow morning, and that's really annoying me. It will cause me to lose sleep tonight. But apart from that, minor annoyance. Yes, I'm very excited and very delighted.
Yes, and Catherine will be going there for the full duration of Indian Wells, presenting Prime Video's coverage alongside people like Sam Smith and Daniela Hantikova and Mark Becci and Nick Lester, Robbie Koenig, and I'm forgetting somebody, I can't remember who.
Greg
Rusedski. Sorry, Greg. I know you listen, but anyway, that lot.
He's not listening.
No, he'll be listening. He's saving it for the plane, Catherine. yes, so she'll be out there in Indian Wells presenting the coverage in the UK. If you're not in the UK,
and
sorry,
Ireland.
But you know we'll tell you the best bits, and we'll also do regular.
If you're not in the
podcasts.
UK or Ireland, then I was great.
Yeah, let's just leave it at that. Fine, yeah. I would go with that too. Right, this week of tennis, it's just been so full of incident storylines, incredible tennis, drama, controversy, and yet only the kind of good bits of that have really happened to Roger Federer, haven't they, over the last week? Because just as I predicted in the newsletter that we put out, and we put a prediction in every week's newsletter, Federer got his 100th ATP singles title. Well, I say ATP, it's not just ATP, is it? Because it includes Grand Slams, but...
Well,
I don't
Grand
know.
Slams are ATP ratified or endorsed,
yes,
if
they
you
are,
like.
Aren't they?
Yeah.
But it is. First of all, the achievement itself, the title he won, he started slowly, didn't he, in as much as I think a couple of his first matches went three sets. But by the end, when he beat Stefanos Tsitsipas yesterday, 6-4, 6-4, he was really flying.
Yeah, he was absolutely motoring, wasn't he? As he was against Borna Coric in the semi-finals, which was just no contest at all. I know Borna Coric was, I mean, he looked like he barely had the energy to do the walk out onto court and the wave. So it felt that had a, that match had a feeling of being over before it even started. Tsitsipas, I sense, was probably just as tired deep down, but came onto court with a sort of defiant, I'm not going to let that be the story of today. Which it wasn't. I think the story of the day, aside from the headline of 100th career title for Federer, was that he was brilliant, wasn't he? He was smooth as silk. I mean, his volleying, I know there's nothing new left to say about anything relating to Roger Federer, but his volleying was just divine. His the canniness of his play. There's no question he'd learned from what happened in Australia against Tsitsipas. You know, he came out there with kind of perfect tactics and perfect execution and a shaven chin.
Yes, because we had been talking to Grad Matt, who's provided some magnificent stats over the last few days, one of which he and I concocted or conjured up was the fact that we couldn't remember a single title that he had won with a beard. And there's a picture, somebody had taken a montage picture of every single trophy he's lifted. And you saw him, and I think there was one in Shanghai in 2007 where he's got a bit of a beard. But
is it actual beard though? I'm not sure that was beard. Mm. I think that might have been just I've forgotten to shave.
Well, and certainly the early years when he was in 2001 when he won his first title in Milan. I mean, that was not a beard. That was bum fluff. That was the sort of thing that I'm still trying to grow in my 40s. But the fact is that, yeah, I mean, I know it's a ridiculously unscientific thing to come up with.
Well, except that, podcast, David. But, you know, except that he had a beard for the week and shaved for the final.
Yes. Well, you want to look your best, don't you, when you're lifting your 100th trophy? Maybe that's why. Maybe that's what he does every time.
I genuinely think, you know, Roger Federer, a friend of Anna Wintour, et cetera, owner of, you know, multiple. We were speculating on the Tennis Podcast group WhatsApp about whether he would have some sort of 100 or century themed item of clothing in his bag, pre-packed, ready for the trophy ceremony. But it seems that he learned maybe a little lesson from Wimbledon 2009, where we had the five crowns already emblazoned on the embroidered onto the jacket. Was it five at that point, 2009? Yeah,
I can't remember.
It was.
Can't remember
when you know what I'm talking about, when he had the
yes, the and blazer. He had his T-shirt, I think, with eight on it at Wimbledon.
Yes.
Last time he won it there.
I think he had a thought in the back of his mind for what the photos would look like. You know, 100th career title, those are photos that are going to sort of live forever, aren't they? Mm. And I think he wanted them. I think he wanted a timeless Federer, perhaps,
yes,
to feature in those photos. You know, not a dated Federer.
No. by the way,
beards will age less well than a bare chin. Probably.
I wouldn't know. Can't grow one. I've been trying many a time. But you talked about how there's not much more to say about Federer because he's won all of these titles. And
what have you got, David? What have you got to say? Hit me.
I think what I have got to say is the fact that we've gone through another period of wondering whether he has got it in him anymore. I feel of late, and I still feel like, yeah, but this is best of three sets.
Yeah.
And we'll get on to Nick Kyrgios in a little while, and there's and even Alexander Zverev as well. There is such a difference between winning at a slam over five sets, which Federer is the greatest male player we've ever had at doing it, but at the age of 37, 38 this year, there is that question mark. But up against a guy in a shot-making contest like Tsitsipas, who had beaten him last time, who actually really fancies himself against Federer and fancies himself, frankly, against anybody, which is one of the things that is so, I find, slightly endearing, but certainly engaging about Tsitsipas, the fact that he steps onto the court and I don't find it disrespectful of an opponent. I find it just, it's a total self-belief and it's shock if it doesn't work in his eyes. He thinks he's got the game and he was prepared to go toe-to-toe with Federer. And I found it really interesting that this time it was Federer's turn. I do think maybe Tsitsipas was a little fatigued. I do think that the court surface is probably plays into Federer's hands there. I mean, how many has he won there? Several. But he can still do it. He did adapt a little bit for this match. He was shortening those rallies and he took it to Tsitsipas and he won.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the tactical genius of it all. And I mean, still a brilliant week for Tsitsipas. He was so wonderfully open with how important it was and how fixated he was on reaching the top 10, making his debut in the top 10. He said, "I think about it every day." Rather, you know, we're so used to hearing the autopiloted, you know, "I don't think about the rankings." You know, "I just take each match at a time and trust that the ranking will come." No, Stefanos Tsitsipas is opening the ATP rankings homepage every single day and it's sort of hitting refresh every 30 seconds just to see if anything's changed. And I love that. I love that. So, and of course, he's got very little to defend for many months, really.
I know. I mean, he feels like he's been a top 10 player for a long time, doesn't he? Because of the run he's had over the last 4 or 5 months. But you're right. I mean, he has still got some serious inroads to make into that top 10 if he has another good 6 months right now.
Too right. Yeah, too right. It's just another little footnote that's emerged from various bits of coverage from journalists on the ground in Dubai. I had actually forgotten this, but Roger Federer was accused of tanking, wasn't he, in Dubai more than a decade ago. I think it was in maybe 2002,
that's what he said, yeah. Because that would figure, because that was pre him being Roger Federer, really. I mean, that was before his first Grand Slam, you know. And I mean, look, back then,
it was
he did used to throw in performances where you just roll in your eyes.
It was against Fabrice Santoro, who I think could make the best of them roll their eyes back in the day. But he sort of admitted to it, didn't he, in his post-win press conference a couple of days ago. He said he talked about how it made him learn the hard way. Not an explicit confession, but and I think after that, didn't he win 3 Dubai titles on the bounce after that incident? So yeah,
well, that's what I like.
And
about
here
Federer.
He is, he's 37, he's still learning.
Doesn't shy away from his early years. Actually, hold on a minute. In 2002, he lost second round to Rainer Schüttler, 6-3, 6-1. I mean, that is an absolute hammering. And then yes, he then beat Jiří Novák in the final in 2003.
Was it Santoro that went on to win the title that year? Maybe that's why I'm thinking of Fabrice. Fabrice has snuck in to the
04,
podcast.
04, you like this. 04, he beat Lopez. And then 05 in the final, he beat Ivan Lupicic.
Ivan. Yeah, I mean, he's got quite a history at that tournament. I mean, he lives there, as you say. It all suits him brilliantly. Despite it was really windy there this year, wasn't it? Really windy, and sometimes that is not great for single-handed backhands. Luckily, he was playing another single-handed backhand in the final. But
06,
you can see some very spectacular shanks.
06 was the one year I went to Dubai, and he played Nadal in the final. I'm just looking this up, and he lost 6-4 in the third to Nadal. And I remember watching that at the time and being really taken aback. I mean, this is, you know, I think after Nadal's first French Open triumph, so they'd barely played each other. But that was a really shocking moment, because, 06 was a year that Federer got What are you, lost about 3 or 4 matches in the whole year? That is quite a moment. And I remember just seeing that, and Federer won the first set 6-2, and Nadal looked just shell-shocked, but he just wore him down. But yes, I like the fact that Federer is quite candid about his early career. He doesn't pretend that he wasn't immature, that he didn't let himself down, because he did let himself down at times. And, you know, we'll talk about Kyrgios in a little bit, but it wasn't to that degree, but he was so emotional, Federer, that he would lose the plot. And I was just thinking back to 2001 when he won that title in Milan.
That was his first.
Yeah, yeah. He'd been pro for 2 or 3 years at that point. And
yeah, he doesn't look that young in the photo. I mean, obviously he looks young, but he doesn't, compared to some of the baby-faced chaps we've got doing things these days. He looked like a man, a fully formed human man.
It felt like a big deal that he won the title at the time, but the fact is he'd had a number of losses. I mean, I remember a year earlier he'd had, I think, match point against Marc Rosse in Marseille and lost that, and he was tearful after that. He played the Milan predecessor. He had moved actually from London. It was in London for 3 years at the Battersea Park tent, and then at the London Docklands Arena in 2000, at a tournament where Federer beat Goran Ivanišević in a match where they both had ponytails, and then he lost to Rosse and again was just in tears. This was happening regularly back then. And yeah, Julien Boutet is the man that he beat in that Milan final. Ooh. And there's this great stat unearthed by ATP Media Info, which Matt's put in our agenda here, that back then in 2001, the other 31 players in that draw have all retired now. And the surface on which that tournament was played, indoor carpet, is no longer used at all anywhere in tennis, because it used to be this lightning quick surface that Goran Ivanišević basically had to look at in order to win on it, and it was just deemed too fast for tennis, so they no longer use it anymore. So yeah, Federer's won on literally everything, and it will be interesting now, won't it, to see whether he can get anywhere near Connors on 109, which is the record.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a lot, doesn't it? But he's already confirmed he's going to play Dubai again next year. So he'll be 38 and a half by that point. So he's obviously feeling bullish about it all.
He is, but at the same, I mean, you might say it's just a diplomatic answer, the one he gave when he was asked about if he thought he could get close to Connors. And he said, I'm at a stage of my career now where I don't need to hold all the records. And I looked at him and I thought, I think I believe you. I don't know how you.
But I think he might feel differently if he's on 108.
Yes, no, I
think
with you there.
I think there's no point in making that the be all and end all, because I think it's more likely that it won't happen at this stage. So there's no point in making that the goal. A bit like the WAF about, you know, the focus on the wins and the rankings will come, you know, focus on winning the tournaments you enter and the record will come. But if he gets to 107, 108, I think suddenly he'll be thinking about that every waking minute possibly.
Do you think he will get close to that?
I think he might get close enough that we start talking about it more. I think, as I say, if I had to say now whether he'll do it, I think no. But you could see him, you know, imagine he gets to 105. Imagine the ATP 250 tournaments, the ones with the slightly easier draw sheets usually, that might be thinking, oh, maybe I could lure in Roger Federer with the offer of a slightly softer run to 107th, 8th, 9th, 10th title. Could get interesting.
Suddenly he's playing,
you know, if
Montpellier.
He played in Rio next week, last week, sorry, that he would have been the heavy favourite in the draw. Clay?
Really?
Well, after the first round, when every top seed had gone, would you not put him as the favourite against Auger, Aliassime, and Jer in the final.
Looking at, do you know what? I felt as though it had been a long time since he'd won a title, but actually, he won four titles last year. He won Basel, Stuttgart, Rotterdam, and the Australian Open. Before the year before that, he won seven. In 2015, he won six. So, I mean, he's going to play next year. So he's already won one this year. If he were to win four this year and four next year, then yeah. I mean, yeah. I know that sounds like a big assumption, but
it's
still.
It's all about the schedule. Yeah. If he's going to do it, it will require some nifty manoeuvring on the schedule, I think. You know, somewhere like Budapest might be rubbing its hands together.
Yeah. Well, 54% on the pole vault say
Do you think he could play Queens and Halle? Like fly between the two?
That's illegal, I think.
If they had to create a rule to cover that?
Yeah. No, I mean, the only time I've ever seen somebody play twice in the same week was Tim Henman when he played the Telford Nationals, won it, and then flew all the way to, I think, Munich to play in the Grand Slam Cup, I think it was, or something like that. We're going back about 20 years. There was also the one where Joe Wilfried Tsonga, I think, or was it Joe Wilfried Tsonga? Yes, it was, who played in the Challenger in Surbiton, won that, and then played qualifying at Queens the same day.
My first ever year at Queens, David.
And Stefanos Tsitsipas will be having his first ever year at Queens this year. That's a nice signing for us, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, there are people that make you buy tickets that you say, I will pay money to watch that person, and he's on that list for sure, I think, for most tennis fans. So, yeah, I think that's awesome.
And tickets are available, so you can go and get some if you'd like now. Lots of fantastic segues here, Catherine. Well done. You're setting me up beautifully. So Federer's won Dubai. Did anything else notable happen in the week that you want to talk about? I'm trying to think who beat who.
He got to the semifinals. He backed up Marseille to an extent, I think perhaps to more of an extent than we might all have been expecting from him.
Yeah, he looks really in great form, doesn't he? And he's throwing himself at people rather than just scampering around the back of the court.
He hit 174 kilometer per hour forehand.
Crikey.
Against Tsitsipas. That is the Gael Monfils that I want to see.
Yes. Just chuck everything
more
at the opponent.
More of that, please. The other Gael Monfils that I want to see is the one that, alongside his girlfriend Alina Svitolina, gets video bombed by Roger Federer, because that was unquestionably a highlight of my week. If you haven't seen it, it is all over the internet. Make sure you see it.
Yes, the internet is useful sometimes, and in this instance,
They're trying to do a cutesy couples video for their joint Instagram page, which we've referenced before, Gem's Life. And Roger Federer just sneaks up behind them like an uncool dad, and it's just, it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
And I can vouch for the fact that it was very uncool dad-like, because that is exactly the sort of thing that I do on a regular basis. Joe Salisbury, British player, and his American partner Rajiv Ram won the doubles title. So well done to Joe. They're in the top eight in the race to London. That just about wraps up Dubai.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. On to Acapulco, Catherine, because...
Let's go loco. I mean,
we've got to go loco because everybody else has out there.
Yeah.
Nick Kyrgios.
Living up to the name.
Seemed as though he was going loco on a number of occasions over the course of the week. I mean, I don't really know where to start. I mean, first of all, Catherine, just to reel off the people that he beat, Andreas Seppi in the first round, Rafael Nadal second round, Stan Wawrinka in the quarterfinals, John Isner in the semis, I think in a third set tiebreak, and then in the final, Alexander Zverev, and he beat him 6-4, 6-3. It was interesting to see that Zverev actually had more break points, but when you're watching the match, it didn't feel like that. It always felt like Kyrgios was in control. But that doesn't even come close to describing the week of tennis that we've witnessed, because I think we saw just about every single side of Kyrgios. Ultimately, it was all wonderful, but we saw everything, didn't we?
Oh, we did. And there's so much to see with Nick Kyrgios, because he's everything, isn't he?
Has he dragged you back in
he's
again?
He's awful and wonderful all at once. He's... has he dragged me back in again? I'm trying not to frame it in that way, because I am trying, David, to celebrate this wonderful achievement of Kyrgios's as just that, a wonderful achievement, and not fall into the trap of thinking, but what does this mean? Does this mean that Kyrgios has turned a corner? Does this mean he's, you know, going to start doing Pilates and sort his posture out? Does this mean he's going to hire a coach? Does this mean he's going to, you know, have a lobotomy and change his personality completely and start being a really committed, knuckled-down tennis player? The answer to all of those things is no. He could still, you know, rock up and win Indian Wells next week. Absolutely. I'm just not going to think about whether that's more or less likely than it was 2 weeks ago, because it's kind of irrelevant, isn't it? Nick Kyrgios, I haven't learnt anything new about Nick Kyrgios this week. I've been pleasantly and in some ways unpleasantly reminded of lots of things about him, and they've been renewed in my mind. But nothing's new, and one brilliant week is something we've seen from Kyrgios before. So I'm not prepared to do the Kyrgios dance of but what if? What does this mean? You can do it on your own if you like, but yeah, it will be a monologue.
I was doing it a few times this week.
And where did you get to? Where did you end up?
Well, I mean, first of all, let's just tell you about the week a little, the ups and downs of it, because against Nadal, he had both knees strapped. He lost the first set. He was basically saying that he was going to quit, that he was going to retire from the match. He felt sick. There'd been a bug going around the whole place, and he was having treatment repeatedly throughout the match. He was match points down, 6-3 down in the third set tiebreak, which is one of the most extraordinary comebacks I've ever seen, really, given the two players that you got on the court. I mean, two of the match points he saved were drop shots, which became a theme of the week. It became arguably his most potent weapon throughout the course of the week, was the drop shot. And then he Nadal double faulted. It felt like his brain was just scrambled, and it reminded me of that quote from Jeff Tarango years and years ago when Nadal was at his absolute peak. How'd you beat Nadal? What would you do? I'd get in his kitchen, he said, and scramble his brains. Because what else can you do when he's playing at his absolute best? Then you had the match against Wawrinka, which was just a shot maker's paradise. These two players just teeing off with bullets at each other. That was a fantastic win, with a few ups and downs as well. And I mean, in these two matches as well, the crowd were going at Kyrgios in a way that I don't think I've ever seen any crowd. They really didn't like what he was putting up there at times. They were totally against him, and the worse that got, the more he seemed to enjoy it and almost bring it on himself, as though he wanted it. And then you had the match in against John Isner, which revealed to me what an incredible returner of the serve that Kyrgios is against a big server. His ability to just see a ball coming at him at peak speed and middle it back, particularly on the backhand side. I've seen him do that against Feliciano Lopez with the swinging left-handed serve. He has that ability with the short-armed stab of a backhand to get it back. And then in the final, frankly, he made, and I've seen him do this a few times against Zverev, he made him look one-dimensional. Zverev is a brilliant tennis player who hits every single tennis shot, it looks almost correctly, you know, and they come with power and they come relentlessly. And he just, it was like he just stuck a spanner in the workings of this robot and just made it malfunction. And he did it with drop shots and off-pace slice balls cross-court and bomb serves and then a kicker serve out wide. It was like watching a 6'4" John McEnroe playing a different single ball every single shot and just getting this tall guy at the far end off balance. It was just a joy to watch as a tennis spectacle. But what do I take from it all? I see it differently. Like you, I see it differently these days. I don't think, right, now what? I just think, oh wow, that was good. That was really good fun. I so enjoyed that. And I've become more at peace with that, I think.
Yeah, I mean,
because we haven't had it, have we?
The mastery of the tennis, of the tennis brain, and I'm not even sure it necessarily is brain. I don't mean that. I don't mean that as an insult. I think it's so instinctive to him. It's like he was born within the confines of a tennis court, and those dimensions are so sort of deeply ingrained in his DNA. And I don't know, as you say, the drop shots and when to play them. I mean, there was one point in the final against Zverev where Zverev got so visibly irritated, angry, enraged at Kyrgios for making him look foolish with a run to a drop shot. He you know, Kyrgios was celebrating his drop shot winner up at the net, and Zverev is looking bereft there, and he looks at him like, "How dare you humiliate me like that?" And he made Zverev look so plodding. He made Zverev look like, do you remember when I watched almost the entirety of Nishikori against it was Karenia Busta, wasn't it, at the Australian Open, and it was a brilliant match with lots of drama and long rallies, but it sort of occurred to me halfway through that it looked like nobody was trying to win the point, that they were just enjoying hitting it back to one another. Kyrgios made Zverev look like he wasn't that bothered about winning points, that he was just sort of hitting the ball soft pace, comfortably inside all the lines, not really trying to get his opponent on the move too much, not really trying to do too much with it, just sort of, ordinary. He made him look really ordinary, like he wasn't trying to win the point as much as Kyrgios was. And surely a tactic with Kyrgios has got to be to get him on the move, to get him into uncomfortable positions. Kyrgios looked just so comfortable all the time. He was just completely in command. It was extraordinary. It was just an absolute piece of wizardry, that
match. And did you notice as well that in that final there was no strapping on the knees, there was no whining, complaining about feeling unwell?
Everything's in his mind, David.
Well, the vast majority
apart from those shoulders, which need some, that the posture distresses me, David. He must be sort of aching all the time.
Somebody
give those shoulders a massage.
He teases himself in post-match interviews, doesn't he, about how, look, Zverev is the model professional. What a role model he is. He does everything right. Me, I have to hit drop shots because I'm not as fit as him and I can't keep going in the rallies as long. You know, he pokes fun at himself, which does endear you to him a bit. But
But to deal with the counter to that, yes, he does have the capacity to be very self-aware and self-effacing, and that is endearing. But then you've also got the Instagram post that he put up after the victory over Nadal, when really all he needed to do was, I mean, he did all the talking on the court, not just with his tennis, but with his reactions. You know, he lets you know how he's feeling. He didn't need to say anything, and yet he said not just something. He said, I mean, I almost don't want to repeat it because it was sort of borderline slanderous. But
it was uncomfortable to look at it. And as you say, I felt it was unnecessary as well. But the thing with him is that you even go through these undulations in the course of a week watching him. I mean, we've always said you can do the same in a match. You can't take your eyes off him. You don't know what's coming next. All the good things that you get. And there's a couple of things. One is it reminds me of watching him against Nadal when he was getting booed, and a lot of people were chiming in, and a lot of, and I think we have tired of the circus in recent times because he's just not been doing anything to back it up. You know, it's all well and good doing all this stuff if you're still progressing and winning, but he's been going down in the rankings. But in terms of his behavior and all that sort of thing, what I don't want to see is him not owning it, him acting like that and then blaming everybody else for it. You know, either you are up for a fight and you're going to take people on and you're going to shush people and all that sort of stuff, or you're not. Don't try and have it both ways. And I remember back in the day when Marcelo Rios was world number one, and I remember he had a piece written about him in Sports Illustrated on the front cover, the most hated man in tennis. And he was world number one at the time, and it was just it was regarded as such a damaging article for the sport that you got this guy at the top who was world number one and everybody hated him, and his attitude was appalling and all this sort of thing. And I remember sitting in back when I was at the ATP, and I remember sitting in a PR brainstorming meeting about what do you do about this situation. And I was of the opinion, well, look, if he wants to be the bad guy, let him be the bad guy. Let's promote him as the bad guy. Let's say he's the Darth Vader of tennis. Fine. If he wants it that way, let's not pretend he's some great guy, because he's not. And with Kyrgios, I just feel there's a mixture in there.
I think Kyrgios wants you to think he's a great guy. And I think in many ways he is a great guy. But he's an awful lot of things, as well as being a great guy.
But I think
he's not a headline. But he also makes people write a lot of headlines about him, but he just doesn't fit into... a thousand words isn't enough to describe all the complexity. It's like I was listening back to our show after the US Open final this year with Serena and Osaka, and Serena's the same. She's all sorts of things. She's at once a inspirational role model, incredible woman, and also, you know, somebody that can make you feel quite uncomfortable and do behave badly and do bad things. And of course, subsequently, she's not taken any ownership of the bad things she did at the US Open, really. So that's disappointing, but she's still an inspiration. But these things don't fit neatly into headlines, do they?
The other thing is, and twice over the course of this week watching Nick Kyrgios, twice he has made me think of the boxer Tyson Fury. Once when he made that comeback against Nadal, which just seemed so absurd that he would come back from 6-3 down in a tiebreak against Nadal on match point. Who does that? I can't think of anybody who's done that against Nadal before. And it reminded me of Tyson Fury getting knocked apparently spark out in the final round by Deontay Wilder, the biggest puncher in the sport, and just sitting up at 9 and getting to his feet and then subsequently outboxing him and almost knocking the other guy out at the end of the fight. And also the quotes of Kyrgios after the final talking about the dark places that he's been to and saying that if I can come through those, then you, if you're struggling, so can you, because I was in a really bad way. And Fury has had a lot of publicity for being very vocal about his mental health issues. And I don't want to talk too presumptively about Kyrgios, because I don't know the guy. I don't know his specific case and how severe his issues might have been. I have no knowledge of it, but I could imagine that he is somebody who does have incredible ups and downs, and a lot of people do. It doesn't. I think we can look at tennis players and celebrities and sports stars and sometimes think, oh, why aren't they doing this? Why aren't they doing that? And we don't really know what they're going through mentally. And I do wonder how Kyrgios is wired, to be quite honest. So I always try to bear that in mind. But just in terms of viewing where he is and everything else and all this stuff about whether he's good for the game or not good for the game.
Oh, we're not doing that, David.
Look, the only thing I want to say is
he's good and bad for the game.
He is.
End
all
of
I
story.
Want to say about it is the only thing I want him to be is relevant and to be playing at a level more often that makes us talk about him, because talking about him is entertaining. But frankly, over the last 18 months, he's largely been an irrelevance. And that is what I don't want.
Do you know what I want?
Go on.
More pictures of Nick Kyrgios wearing a sombrero and holding a large silver pear. I tell you what, next time I'm experiencing ups and downs, I will look at that photo and it will cheer me right up.
I dare say. Well, he also, Catherine, against Rafa Nadal, hit an underarm serve, which prompted a heated exchange of views between yourself and I over WhatsApp. What's your view of the underarm serve of Nick Kyrgios? Because I think it's absolutely fine, and anybody can do one at any time, and I've no issue with it.
Well, as somebody pithily summed up for me on Twitter, I'm really sorry, I can't remember quite who it was, but I am going to look up now. It's within the rules, therefore, you know, go for your life, do it, as long as it's within the rules. I've got no problem. I absolutely don't think for a moment it shouldn't be in the rules. What I took the conversation to be was sort of an assessment of how obnoxious we find it when somebody does an underarm serve, because it can be obnoxious.
Why?
I should have prepared better for this rather than just saying, oh, it's a sort of intangible obnoxiousness. In the same way that a lot of it has sort of a whiff of arrogance about it, doesn't it? It has a whiff of...
Loads of shots have that, don't they?
Well, yeah. I mean, you could absolutely make the same case for the sabre. And a lot of people, you know, Boris Becker said that he thought the sabre was disrespectful, didn't he?
Yeah, that's true.
You could absolutely apply it. I think it is I think we had this discussion, was it French Open last year? It is, in principle, a very valid tactic against Nadal. But he tried it once, Kyrgios, and it missed a foot long, and then he didn't try it again, which doesn't say tactic to me. It says sort of, oh, he's just gone, oh, I'm just going to do whatever on this point. I'm just going to
just put a.
I'm just going
to.
I'm just
going to
sort of check out for a moment. I don't know. I know. What I'm saying is not very scientific, but sometimes you see a thing and it just makes you go, "Oh, mate, don't do that."
You said it depended on who it was and when it happened.
Yeah, context.
Yeah, but Roger Federer does a sabre. You don't find that obnoxious.
Well, I think it validly can be interpreted as obnoxious. I don't, because it's, oh, I don't know, this is awfully unscientific, isn't it? Look, I'm perfectly happy for players to do it, and I think the more players do it, the less obnoxious it will be to do it. Do you know what I mean? But some things are within the rules, but they're just generally, you know, there are sort of understandings in sport, aren't there?
No, I just don't buy it. Like not taking injury time out
before your opponent serves. That's within the rules.
Yeah, okay, I accept that one. I accept that one, that does appear to be something that bothers players. I just think, you know...
Are there not any circumstances, David, in which you'd see an underarm serve and go, not at all. Not any. Oh, that's interesting.
No,
okay.
I mean, you're basically saying then that Mansour Bahrami has no place on the tennis tour.
Oh, come on, David.
You are. Because he was denied opportunities to play tennis, and if he'd have played regularly, he'd have been playing the way he plays. And he did. I mean, I think he reached a final once, didn't he? Or at least a doubles final.
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that because I don't find, I wouldn't find him doing it. Well, actually, I think John McEnroe would have found it obnoxious.
Well, he did.
And frequently has done on the Champions Tour.
Back in the days when I was on the Champions Tour, we're going back 20 years, I remember one pretty heated row I got into with McEnroe. Because I said to McEnroe, he was complaining about having to play Bahrami. He was drawn in the singles group with him, and he says, "What have I got to play Bahrami for? Again, you know, or he's just going to keep doing all these tricks." And it's really, it really annoys me. It really irritates me when I'm trying to play a proper match. You know, it's fine in the doubles, but I don't want to play it in singles. You know, I want it to be competitive and all this. And I said to him, "John, do you know what I'd love to see? I'd love to see you play against Bahrami properly. When Bahrami's doing all of his tricks and you're not just playing along, you're just going to try and beat him. Because I think that his tricks could really annoy you and might make it difficult." That wasn't a very good idea to say that to John McEnroe, who subsequently beat Bahrami 6-love, 6-1. And almost every time he hit a winner, he was turning around and saying, "See?" like this towards me. But I have absolutely no problem with Mansour Bahrami playing underarm serves, which is what he was doing. If you can do it and get away with it, go for it. If you can't get away with it,
but
you
as
lose
I say,
point.
Context is everything. Mansour Bahrami isn't out there to win tennis matches. Mansour Bahrami is purely out there to entertain.
No, but when he played his career, he was trying to win tennis matches.
But in a it was, you know, it was Monfils times 10, wasn't it? It was, "I'd like to win, but more importantly, I'd like to entertain people."
But I would have no problem. If Monfils, for instance, played that sort of rope-a-dope type tennis that he did against Djokovic and was winning, and it was irritating his opponent into submission by hitting drop shot returns every single time and underarm serves every other serve, I would have no issue with it whatsoever.
Okay. Yeah,
Tennis. It's just another type of tennis, and I mean, look, Kyrgios did it to a certain degree.
But then the more widespread it becomes, the less obnoxious incidents of it will be.
Oh, I just don't find it obnoxious.
Fine,
that's all. Anyway,
You're a slice and dicer, though.
I am, and my victory against Solihull Simon was the first time.
Oh, I really didn't mean to set you up for that.
Yeah, the first time that I've ever played where I accepted my slice and dice game.
Yeah, hang on, did you beat him outright, or did you just take a set?
I won a set.
Right. So when you say when I beat Solihull Simon, that's
all right. Well, when
that's
I won
misleading.
A set.
That's misleading, isn't it?
Well, I already beat him. Love 6-1-4 retired. So all right. Well, this is my first proper set that I've won. Okay, and I accept my slice and dice game for what it is, i.e. I am not good enough to play the tennis that I have in my head, which is how I've been playing for the last 25 years, which is trying to play proper tennis and just not being good enough to play it. So rather than play that, I've played what I can do, and actually I was a way better player because I finally accepted it, and no longer will I be trying to go for massive forehands and big backhands.
I'm imagining a scenario where it's, you know, 4-all. I'm locked in battle at 4-all with my brother. I mean, obviously, this is a fantasy because that's never going to happen. And it's been, you know, real rollicking good match. Winner, winner, winner. Great. And then he underarm serves me. I'm standing 2 metres behind the baseline to receive his whopping big 6-foot-6 serve. And then he underarm serves me. And he wins the point, and that's great. And good luck to him. But I would forevermore like him a tiny bit less from that moment onwards.
Well, at least
and
you're
honest.
And
that's why it's a little bit obnoxious. That's never happened, by the way. Okay. Well, I still like my brother. But,
there you go, Matt. I think you can pull it off.
Yeah.
All right. A few other headlines before we go, because Catherine's literally about to get on a plane, one sleep away to go to Indian Wells to be a big star on telly. It's Cameron Norrie who's reached the semi-finals in Acapulco. That's his best ever result out of 500. I think he goes into the top 50, the British player. The Zverev brothers went on to win the doubles. That was a good result for them. The women's event, Wang Yafan beat Sophia Kenin in the final. Indian Wells challenger is currently being contested by a Mr. Kyle Edmund against Andrei Rublev, which also featured Dan Evans to the semi-finals before he lost to Rublev. But quite important, I think, for Edmund to have got these few wins under his belt. I mean, I think it is a bit weird that he's a top 30 player who's allowed to play in a challenger. I'm not quite sure how. I didn't think that was allowed, to be honest. I thought they had to play a 500 if they were in the same week. But maybe I've got my rules wrong there. But yeah, don't you think it's quite important for him to have got a few matches?
I mean, he hadn't won a match this year. Had he?
No, that's right.
So he's still yet to win a tour level match this year. So, huge in that context.
He needed that. Sao Paulo, Guido Pella has won the title, beating Christian Garin. And also, Naomi Osaka has hired her coach. It is not Sven Groeneveld, much as I hoped that it might be, just to save face. But in the end, it turned out to be Jermaine Jenkins, the former hitting partner of Venus Williams, who I think only just got given a job at the USTA about 2 months ago. So anyway, that's who Naomi Osaka has hired as a coach. And John Wertheim of Sports Illustrated actually expressed surprise that Osaka hadn't gone for somebody that had already won, you know, with a top player. And I said, well, my immediate reaction was, well, yeah, but she's already a winner. So I don't. It's not like she needs somebody to hand her the key to unlock this, you know, far off treasure chest. You know, it's something she already knows how to do. And I'd have thought she just wants to have somebody who's just going to make her feel good to be around. Really.
Yeah, I agree.
David Goffin is back with Thomas Johansson. I suspect that will be a good partnership.
I was on the same flight to Australia with Thomas Johansson.
No, you weren't. You thought you were.
No,
but you turned out not to be.
But then I took the picture and I showed you and you said, yeah, that's definitely Thomas Johansson.
Except that it wasn't him, because you said he had an Essex accent.
I know, but I must have got it wrong, honestly. You've seen the picture. If that's on a flight to Australia, like 4 days before the Australian Open, he was absolutely anatomically identical in every way to Thomas Johansson.
Everybody's got a doppelganger, haven't they?
Except that he spoke in an Essex accent. But maybe he's just throwing people off the scent because, you know, he would otherwise
identity.
Be inundated with autograph hunters. I don't know. Right. But I feel mostly confident that I was on the plane with Thomas Johansson.
Okay. Who are you going to be on the plane with tomorrow, I wonder? Find out next week here on the Tennis Podcast. We have a Fed Cup draw of Great Britain against Kazakhstan at the Copper Box Arena in London.
And it's very cool.
Yes. And I've never been there, I don't think. So that'll be interesting.
It was one of the Olympic venues for anyone that isn't familiar with the Box of Copper.
Yes. And final little news item that Matt has put down here for us. Justin Gimelstob case postponed again. There were reports that he'd entered a guilty plea, but Gimelstob has denied those. It turned out that those were not correct. And Gimelstob says, I maintain my innocence and will only consider a contest plea. So we'll find out in due course what happens with Justin Gimelstob's case. So, Catherine, go and have your final toothbrushing experience with your electric toothbrush.
Well, it's the night before. Two toothbrushing experiences, David.
Right.
I'm not a monster.
Okay. Yes, well, I agree. Have those two and then pack it and then off you go. Travel well. I hope you have a fantastic time in Indian Wells. And we will still have you on the Tennis Podcast, won't we?
Try and keep me away.
Hey, excellent. Catherine Whittaker here on the Tennis Podcast, presenting Prime Video's coverage of Indian Wells over the next couple of weeks. Make sure you tune in and cheer her along because, you know, she needs your backing and she'll be brilliant. And we will be back with another show next week. in association with the Telegraph, executive produced by tennisballs.com, with our mascot, Rio with a Y. Check him out, by the way, on our Instagram page. We have posted a few facts and little tidbits of information about Rio with a Y. He's a cool dog. Check him out. We'll be back again next week. See you then.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.